This is episode 11 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is episode 11 of season 7 of the GNU World Order. I'm Klaatu. I'll be your host today, and we're going to talk about a couple of different things. A lot of video. I want to talk about video. I haven't talked about that in a while, or at least it feels like I haven't. So we'll talk about that, talk about software, good software, bad software, how to tell the difference, something like that. We'll talk about Thunderbird release 10, which is sort of timely, and probably some other stuff too, so let's get started. Lately, of course, I've been doing listener feedback right up in front and center, but this past week, there hasn't really been any listener feedback to speak of. There's been correspondence and everything, but nothing new and exciting and revolutionary. It's just kind of been carrying on conversations that started a while ago, so nothing really to review there, except one little thing. Deep Geek had emailed me about a security-related email that we got, he and I both got, on this shared host that we have space on, and it was about a WordPress vulnerability, this exploit that's out there. It's actually not for WordPress directly, it's actually for a little, I guess it's a theme install, like a theme related file. It's a plugin, it's a third-party plugin. It's called timthumb.php, and it's, I guess, some kind of thumbnail generator or something. I'm not really sure what it's used for exactly, but it's something about thumbnails, and one of the things that it does, this little plugin, is it has this default whitelist of sorts, from what I'm gathering, that allows files to be uploaded to its to a cache directory in TimThumb from remote sites. So I think one of them was blogger.com or whatever, and so you could actually upload straight from that site into someone's WordPress installation, essentially. And so someone uploaded a little shell application encoded in Base64, so it was especially hard to, like, grep for and everything, popped that into this cache directory or this temp directory, and then was able to execute that file just like any other file on the remote, on a web server. You know, you just type in the name, and it executes, and so they had literally a shell right into that person's web host and took advantage of it. So if you've got WordPress installs out there, you might want to just kind of double-check, see what kind of plugins you've got installed, see what kind of code they are using, and probably, you know, just make sure you're kind of up to date on all the security stuff. And Deep Geek's point, really, I guess, for sending me this wasn't so much the WordPress thing, because I don't think I really have any WordPress sites out there, but it's kind of, you know, his argument was in the email, how do you feel about not keeping things simple? You know, WordPress, as great as it is, and as friendly as it is, and as much as people love it, and as much as I love it, it's not exactly a simple hosting thing. And he has a point. He makes a really good point. I mean, when you keep things simple, you got static web pages, things like that, it's a lot, I guess, harder to just come up with random, obscure exploits for something like that. Whereas WordPress, with all these different layers of things, it becomes very complex and hard to kind of keep track of, especially for people who don't even know how to grep or find. You know, I mean, they don't even know if they've got TimThumb installed, much less would they know how to look for it. So it does become pretty complex. I don't know how I feel about that yet. I mean, deep down, I feel like Deep Geek is right. I mean, I'm all for plain text web. I don't really get the whole scripting stuff and the flashy web graphic stuff. I really don't. That doesn't appeal to me as much as just the pure informational aspect of the internet. In that sense, I agree. Seems like managing a web server at all is enough work. Why would you then install some big fancy monolithic application on that web server and then manage that on top of just making sure that your web host is being managed? When you look at it that way, I think it just becomes shifting of responsibility, because most people out there hosting a WordPress site, or I shouldn't say most, but a lot of WordPress users are not actually hosting their own web server. They're letting some other group do that, so the people who are managing the security of the computer itself is some company. You know, it's like Wired Tree or Nistrum. Those are just the hosts that I'm kind of associated with. But they're the ones doing all the hosting and making, you know, keeping up with the, hopefully keeping up security stuff, making sure that their boxes aren't being exploited. So that alleviates you, the user, from having to worry about that. And it kind of almost necessarily does, because you really don't have root. I mean, unless it's a, like a VPS or something, you don't have root enough to monitor your own server. So it really does abstract that away from you. But then if you're going to do the whole WordPress thing, then you've got to know you're now taking on that responsibility. And I think part of what WordPress is for a lot of people is something that they don't have to learn, you know, that it's easy to use and it's friendly and they don't have to understand anything. And when they want a thumbnailer, they can just do a search in the WordPress plugin search bar and five different choices come up and you just choose the first one that you see and it just magically works. And that's the pleasure of using WordPress. And this is a theme I think that's just going to kind of keep going within the geek community. And that is that just because we, quote, we, like they, have made it easier for us, it doesn't mean that you get to stop learning about what you're doing. And that's what the general public, I think, is highly resistant to. If you tell someone who doesn't even understand what the web is, who doesn't even understand how their computer works, and you tell them that they can use WordPress, but that they should really try to start learning a little bit about how this stuff works so that they're not doing stupid stuff like installing bonsaibuddy.php on their WordPress as a plugin. You know, I mean, they've got to understand this stuff, and they just don't, and there's no interest in understanding it. That's going to be a problem. It's going to be a problem on WordPress. It's going to be a problem on their computers. It's going to be a problem everywhere, including to kind of start to segue into the rest of the show on video stuff. You know, I keep telling people, look, it's super easy now. Everyone knows how to video edit now. You know, everyone has got kind of a concept of how that stuff works. It's getting easier every day, very accessible. Everyone can make movies. Great. But no one wants to learn about the video codecs. No one wants to understand how to transcode. No one wants to care about that sort of thing. And if they don't, then they go out, they spend all their time shooting something, and then they get back to their editing station, and it turns out that none of their files will be supported by their video editor. And then what do you do? There you go. Education. You know, I mean, people who don't want to learn about this stuff are just kind of dooming themselves to not ever really grasping what's going on, and that puts them in a really weird position. But conversely, it puts us geeks in a really healthy position of supporting those people. And I mean, if you think about it, that's kind of the model of a lot of different businesses. I keep thinking of cars for myself, because I know I don't know enough about cars as I should. I really should know a lot more about this stuff. I don't. And I pay a lot of money to people, for people to repair cars. Well, I mean, I don't really, but if I had a car that I used a lot and something happened to it, I would have to pay a lot of money. And in the past, when I did have a car, I paid a lot of money for people to fix these stupid things because I never knew what to do with them. I never knew what kind of oil they took. I don't know how to change oil. I don't know anything about that stuff. And that puts me at a disadvantage, whether or not it's worth my time and can I get myself to learn that stuff. That's up to me. And that's kind of how I see all this stuff. So yeah, teach people about computers or don't, and make a lot of money off of them. Either way, you get to use computers, and so you're happy. Okay, let's talk about other stuff. Speaking of not having to learn complicated topics, let's talk about email. Of course, we've talked about email before. A couple of seasons ago, I gave a tutorial about the mail spool and setting it up with Mutt and all this other stuff. And we talked about it this season again, when we gave more specifics about the mail spool with the listener feedback. So we've talked about email. We know that it's complex and it is not easy to understand or set up or deal with. One thing that has always been sort of amazing to me, and I think in a way this has been kind of a problem, is that email clients themselves are just really, really hard to set up. You know, I mean, you pick whatever email client is out there, whether it's Thunderbird or K9 Mail or Claws or what's that other one, Silfeed or something, I don't know. Lots of clients out there, K-Mail, what's the other one, Evolution, lots of clients out there, and yet they're really hard to set up. You know, you launch them and they start asking you for things like your name. What do they mean by my name? Do they mean my name or my username? Okay, well, let's just put something in that field. And then they ask for our username. Well, wait a minute. Do they mean our just the username string, or do they want the username at domain name? And then let's just put something in there. And then they ask for a password. Do they mean my computer password? I mean, depending on your level of knowledge, that might be a question that goes through your mind. What do they mean, my mail password? Do I remember my mail password? You put something in that field, and then you click next, and then it's asking you about server settings, and they're asking you for your incoming server. Well, I don't know. The domain name is this, but maybe the mail server is something different. I'm not really sure. I'll just put a guess in there. what port do you want to use? I have no clue. And they kind of give you some options, so you kind of click around, and then they're asking you for outgoing stuff, and the return address, and just all kinds of things. And then they're asking you about SSL, and TLS, and plain text, and authentication. It's so confusing, it's mind-boggling. And no one seems to be helping with this. You know, it seems like you never get anything simplified from anyone. The only exception to that whole thing, that joke of a process, of course, is webmail. Webmail makes it really easy, i.e. you go to the webmail page and you sign up and you're in. That's it. And you don't have to have an email host. You never have to configure that. You just go online and you go into the webmail interface and that's it. That's how easy it is. Some people theorize, well, people are comfortable on the web. It's something they understand. It's easy for them. Yes, that's true, but there's a little bit more to it than that, I think. And the difference is the length of time it took me to describe both processes. The web host, the webmail thing, you sign up and then you sign in, and that is it. It's all you have to do. And if you want to do your own webmail, then you have to know how to get a URL, how to get a domain name, how to sign up your account for the web hosting, for the email server, and then how to get to your webmail interface on your own host. That would be sort of the easy way to do it. And already there's all these different concepts that people just, it's really difficult to understand. There's also the free aspect. I know when I was first getting into email, there was no reason to look into getting my own domain because that cost money and every webmail host out there was free. But I think even more so, like one of the big disadvantages of originally selling the idea of email to people was how complex it was to set it up. So that was a problem, I think. And I think that battle's probably lost. I don't think that there's going to be a big movement, even as an anti-Google move. You know, I just don't think people are going to see it as an option of, oh, I'll just get my own domain, myname.me or something, and then I'll just click the activate webmail, and then I'll just log in, and there, I've got my own email host. Which, if you think about it, would be so brilliant and so obvious and so simple and really quite a lot better than everyone feeding everything into Google. I would like it from even a non-Google user standpoint because, I mean, to this day, I'm emailing people on a daily basis to a Gmail account, and I don't know how I feel about that necessarily. I mean, I don't hate it because, I mean, give me a break. You're just trying to talk to people. If they're on Google, then they're on Google. But, and you know, I mean, it's not like my emails are so precious that they can't be seen by Google. But, you know, it's one of those things that's a two-way conversation. And so everyone on Gmail or everyone on Yahoo or everyone on, I guess, whatever Hotmail is now, I guess that doesn't really exist anymore, but whatever that is, or would be, Bing maybe, I don't know, then they're ingesting all of your email if you're emailing them. So it'd be kind of cool if people had actually their own hosting accounts and their own email addresses and their own domains and stuff like that. But it's not going to happen because webmail, I think, you know, hosted webmail has kind of won. But that doesn't mean we can't try to make it better. And one of the things to make all of this better, at least in my mind, is to make those clients a lot more attractive and a lot easier to use. Because right now, or at least up until very recently, they have all been ridiculously complicated to configure. So it turns out that Thunderbird 10 has been released fairly recently, not just yesterday. It's I'm a little bit late on it, but it has been released. It's come out. It's here. It's alive. You can try it right now. Actually, I think it's up to 10.02 right now. But you should check it out because when I launched it to install it on someone's computer and configure it, I was shocked at how good it was. Meaning that previously in Thunderbird, if you typed in that your email address was fubar@gmail.com, then it would just auto-detect pretty much all of your settings really, really nicely. And from what I've seen, this is also true for a lot of the mail clients on like mobile phones and things like that. Like if you typed in a Gmail address, they could all pretty much figure out what all your settings needed to be from that, your password, and whatever displayed name you give them for the from line. And that's it. That's as easy as it can get, and that's good. That's a great thing. And it also obviously really, really encourages people to use Gmail because it's just that easy. Turns out now in Thunderbird 10, it's that easy for everything. So far I've tried it on at least four different hosting accounts for different people. I mean, not just my stuff. This has been for different people from distinctly different hosting providers. And Thunderbird 10 figures it all out with just the login on information, basically. It's really, really exciting. I'm assuming it's basically just going to a command line, you know, and typing in host, for instance, GNU worldorder.info, gives you back right there where the mail is handled, you know, who is setting the mail for that domain. So I'm assuming that's what it's doing essentially, and then just probably taking its best guess at the port numbers. I don't remember if it even asks you whether you're doing POP or IMAP. I'm assuming it must, but it is. It reverse engineers it essentially, and it plops all the settings in. And so far, four times I've entered the login information, the domain name, and Thunderbird just starts downloading the messages. It's phenomenally easy. It was amazing. Like, it just when it first happened, I just couldn't believe it. I didn't even dare hope that it would work again for a different provider. I thought, well, that was a GoDaddy account that I was setting up for this one person. GoDaddy's pretty big. Maybe Thunderbird. Maybe that's just an easy target. That was a simple one. Let me try it with one of my own accounts. I tried it with one of my smaller accounts. Worked perfectly. Tried it on another person's account on a completely different server. It's been pretty consistent. It's been completely consistent so far. So if you haven't tried Thunderbird 10, you're looking for a mail client, give it a go. So trying new software is something that I typically enjoy. I will say that generally speaking, I'm the type of person who really does like to try new software. Among my friends, even during my the stage where I was denying that I had any interest in computers, I was always kind of the guy to figure out the software that we had to use for a certain assignment, whether it was a video editing application or a page layout program, whatever. Whatever it was, I'd be the guy to go learn the software. I mean, since this was pre-free software, for me at least, it was find the software, download the cracked version, learn it, and then teach it to all the other people on that project. That, to me, is part of computing. That's part of the fun, you know, getting to discover new software, getting to see how they do something, finding maybe better ways of doing something that you have to do on a daily basis. That's cool to me. It isn't to everyone, and I know that. And it's not always that way for me either. I mean, sometimes I would rather just settle into a program and not consider the alternatives because this is working for me and I have projects that need to happen. And it's practical to continue with the thing that I know rather than explore other options, because exploring other options sometimes is just a form of procrastination. Generally speaking, I like new software. It's something that's fun for me. I was kind of thinking about how we try different software and how we evaluate it for ourselves the other day, and I realized that I kind of go through two different processes, and I thought I might mention them just by way of, well, sharing a process, really. It's just kind of an interesting thing to think about, of how we evaluate software for ourselves. Now, I think there are two kinds of very general categories of software in life. There's software that matters to you, that's really important to you, and there's software whose job doesn't really matter a whole lot to you. It's just for fun. So some of the stuff that's going to matter to you 100% when you switch to GNU Linux, for instance, or when you're getting into some kind of hobby or new job or something, you need to find the software that performs that task that is very important to you. And the way for me, personally, that I find that software, or that I identify the software that's right for me, when it matters, is to throw it into a real-life situation. Something that is real-life, but not terribly time-sensitive. So it's something that you want to get done, but people aren't breathing down your neck yet for it to get done, and so you have some time to shop around. And the only way to find something that's robust enough that really, really works is to put it into a real-life situation. So that's generally what I do when I'm shopping around for software that's important. I give it a run on some real-life examples. If it can handle that, then it gets upgraded to a real-life time-sensitive test, meaning that people are watching, people are waiting for the results. This is always a fun one because everything's going to go horribly wrong, and the thing is that because it's real-life software, things are going to go wrong no matter what you used. So it's just by what degree things go wrong and the quality of the end project. So stuff like this, for me, would be Kden Live, GIMP, Inkscape, Blender, Emacs, GNU Linux itself, FFmpeg, things like that. These are the ones that people are asking me for content or for conversion or for whatever, configuring the network, whatever the task is. It has to happen. It's got to happen relatively quickly. There may or may not be a real live audience standing watching while you're using the software for the solution. And if it continually fails, then you're going to look like an idiot and the task isn't going to get done either. When something fails under those circumstances, I write them off quickly. Allowing, of course, for learning curves and just paradigm shifts and things like that. But that wouldn't be at that stage. That would have been back when I was first evaluating the software. I would account for that. So the live test, that's the one that really counts. And when things start to fail there, yeah, I start to look elsewhere. Now, other times, there is software that will do tasks for you where nothing's really at stake. Examples of these would be, at least for me, an office suite, a web browser, a media player, something like that. They're usually a dime a dozen, and they're doing everyday tasks, and if they fall flat, then you can just really quick, like, fire up another alternative and use that instead. And these are the interesting ones to me because, well, there's nothing at stake, so it's more fun to play around with them. And a lot of times it's kind of almost like figuring out where they're failing and why they're failing. And it's interesting because sometimes a media player will fail miserably playing one H.264 file and yet not another one. Why would that be? What could possibly be causing one file to be non-playable or to crash the player, whereas something else plays fine? So it's always fun for me to see what's going on with these applications. And I guess if I wanted to take it to a next level at some point, I'd make it an actual debug build and really look into it, but I'm not quite there yet. But I usually give these little software things about, you know, an 8, 9, 10 month trial. It doesn't really matter if they fail on an everyday basis. If I fire up Dragon Player in KDE and it crashes, I can just use MPlayer instead. It's not really that big of a deal to me, and it's just kind of fun to play around and see which one is the most robust. But at the end of that trial period, that 9 month trial period, you know, day 262 or whatever it is, 30 times 9 would be, give or take a couple of days. If it crashes on that last day of the trial, if it crashes, then I know that it's not the right one for me, and I install something more reliable. And it almost always ends up, you know, for media players, ends up being some form of MPlayer, whether it's SMPlayer or GMPlayer or whatever, some form of MPlayer, or possibly just MPlayer on the command line, some form of MPlayer, and Firefox is the browser solution every time. And OpenOffice or LibreOffice or whatever for the office. You know, it keeps coming back to these very specific applications, and they never fail. They're just great workhorse fallback applications that simply chug along no matter what platform you're on, no matter what the situation is, and those are the ones that I use on an everyday basis when I need it to work reliably, quickly, every time. So in other words, they're the ones that I'm going to use if someone's standing over my shoulder looking at what I'm doing and I want to put the best foot forward. Or if I'm installing Linux for someone, which I've done just recently like four times over, these are the applications I'm going to be installing for them. I'm not going to be putting KOffice on there and telling them, see how that works for you. You know, that's not what you do. So these are the fallback applications. They're the ones that don't matter to me and yet matter, I guess, to most people, or in a weird way, they're the ones that you use the most. Those are important to note, I think. Those little applications that have that kind of track record and that just keep chugging away, just keep working and working and working through thick and thin, no matter what the stressful situation might be or how unstressful the situation might be. If you need something to get done, you just need it to happen quickly, these are the applications that you can use. And it's important to know what those are, I think, because there's a lot of choice out there in Linux, which is always a good thing. But at the same time, if you lose sight of the ones, like the real ones, you know, the proven ones, lose sight of those, I think you start to risk, I think, knowing what to turn to. For me, it didn't matter for a very long time. It didn't matter. I never had to think about, oh, what should I be pushing as the Linux answer, the fallback app, or not the fallback, the default applications. And then I started kind of really configuring and being responsible for other people's Linux systems, and suddenly I started looking at those applications like, there's no way I'm handing over a computer to someone without LibreOffice or Firefox or SM Player or GM Player, some form of M Player, whatever else. I'm not really thinking of other examples right now, but you know, you've got these applications that you know are the Linux applications. I don't care what desktop you're on. I don't care what environment you're using this box on. These are the computer applications. They are applications that come on a computer. I don't care what operating system it is. You've got to have these kinds of applications, and they need to be reliable and robust, and they need to work every time. And that's that. Knowing those is important, I think. And it's great to have a lot of choice, and it's great to have fun new applications to use, but just keep in mind the ones, you know, and kind of keep an eye out for them, and kind of keep tabs on it when you're doing things at home or at work and something fails. What's the one that you fire up instead because you know it's going to work? Well, that application, that's probably the one that you really want to kind of, I guess, push on other people, or kind of keep in your back pocket to pull out whenever people are working on something and you need it to just work. Well, it's time for a coffee break, so go get that coffee roast that does it for you every time, the one that just works for you, and enjoy. Have a good cup of coffee, and then we'll come back and finish the show by talking about my favorite subject, video conversion. Well, I lied. It's not just about video conversion, but I hope you enjoyed your cup of coffee nevertheless, and we are going to talk about video now. So first, I'm going to talk about FFmpeg, and then we're going to talk about HTML5 and all of the wonderful things that it's doing with video. So FFmpeg, of course, is a great application. It's the other great video transcoder. You might also use Mencoder. I typically default to FFmpeg because it's what I know. It is, as I've said before, I think, one of the very first real Unix applications that I used on my old platform when I discovered a version of it for my old computing platform. Used to use it for all kinds of cool things in the world's worst graphical interface that you could possibly imagine. I used to use it all the time. It was great. FFmpeg was great. The user interface that this person had devised was not. But it was a great little application. I started getting into it on the command line, and next thing you know, I'm using GNU Linux full-time. So I really know FFmpeg pretty well, and it does great things. Well, it turns out that Cobra 2 apparently knows it pretty well, too, because he told me one day that there's a -threads flag. -threads is the thing that allows FFmpeg to create more than just one thread when it's converting video for you. I didn't understand really what this means. I don't know for a fact that I even yet understand what it means. And I Cobra 2 had told me about this quite some time ago in IRC, and I did a quick test right after he told me, and didn't really notice a difference. But just recently, a person here at the filmmaking place that I work at had went out and shot some interviews on a camera that was recording to AVCHD, which is an H.264 codec format, and so you'd think that it would be compatible with the computer that this person was using, this particular platform, which famously or infamously loves H.264. So you'd think it would be a match made in heaven. Turns out it's not. The platform that she was using would not understand this particular form of AVCHD. Doesn't mean it wouldn't understand other forms, understand. It's just this one it wouldn't understand. Very peculiar, these video formats. Cameras and computers, they're never going to get along. But anyway, so I had to do some major conversion for this project. Gigabytes and gigabytes and gigabytes of conversion. Splitting the video from the audio, outputting the audio into separate files because there was just no easy way to get them to be decoded as singular files, and then converting the video to XVID. It was pretty crazy. And like I say, it was gigabytes and gigabytes of HD footage. So I threw it onto my Linux box and started doing the conversions. And I didn't do exact time versus gigabytes versus bitrate kind of tests because I was too busy making sure that this would be done in time for this person's project and that it would actually work with the platform that she was going to be editing on. So I don't have numbers. But I will say that upping the threads to, well, I just tried, I think 4 was the maximum I tried because I didn't know how long it was going to take anyway, and I didn't want to tie up my computer completely, because it was my work computer as well, so I wanted to be able to do other stuff on it. So I did threads 4 for the video conversion part, and it was amazing. It cut the transcoding process down from the previous attempts at the transcoding with just a single thread. It was about 4 hours, I think, and it never actually got through the job. It was just taking too long, and I had to bail out to, like, well, it was within one sitting. I don't remember how long it took, but it was probably an hour. So I'm going to say 4 threads cut it down, and this is unscientific, but I'm going to estimate. Enabling FFmpeg to create 4 threads cut the conversion down from 4 hours and never completing the job to 1 hour and completing the job. So noticeable improvement. Thanks goes out to Cobra 2 for that tip, and obviously thanks goes out to FFmpeg for still being a great converting program. So if you are converting anything ever in your life and you're using FFmpeg, I've done this before, and I'm just doing it now because I can, but this is pretty well documented all over the web as well, so it's not really that big of a deal, but you know, it's FFmpeg is the command, and then -i for your input file. So that would be foo dot, I think it was MST was the file extension. MST is some kind of, you know, muxed stream or something like that. MPEG stream, I don't know. It's something that is ugly and has an H.264 video stream and an audio stream with either 2 or 5 channels, depending on what mode the camera happened to be set on at that time. So I had both to deal with. So the first thing I did was -v codec, as in video codec. So -v codec, and I had to transcode that to libxvid, because that was the only sort of common format that I could really, really guarantee that was going to work between these two platforms. It required special installation on the destination platform, needed a codec for the video engine on that platform, but it's out there, it's freely available in 2 different packages, so it was very, very easy for that to happen on the destination machines. The audio codec I didn't want in the same file, so in my first go, I dropped the audio, so that's -an, so it's like audio no. So -an nullifies the audio. And then I did things like -b for bitrate. the video bitrate, obviously. I think I did like 18,000 kilobits per second. So I think that was just 18,000K. I think I did the frame rate. No, I didn't do the frame rate, actually. I let that default to its native frame rate, which was 59.94. But what I did want to do was custom define the aspect ratio to make sure that it retained the appropriate aspect ratio. So that's just dash aspect space 16:9. And then, of course, the threads, so dash threads 4, and then the output file, so foo.mp4. And that's the command. It outputs it fairly quickly to, and again, this is not something, the thread count you might not even notice if it's a small file. I like I said, my original tests when Cobra 2 first told me about this threads flag was just a little file, and I never did notice the difference because it was trivial. There was a little file. Try a 25 gigabyte file and suddenly things start to change. So then on my second go around, I did sort of the opposite. I did the input being foo.mst again, but I did vn, so video no, and then a codec. Actually, you know what? I didn't even bother defining the a codec or anything, actually. I just did video no, and then I did the output file, foo.wav. And that just auto-detects from the file extension of the destination foo.wav. It knows it's going to be putting it out to a wave format, and it doesn't mess around with the sample rate or the channels or anything like that. It just is basically just ripping the audio streams out of that muxed input file and dumping it into uncompressed raw, not raw, but uncompressed PCM data in a wave wrapper. And that works just fine. So those are just the commands that I happened to use. Just thought it might be good to kind of hear FFmpeg again. A lot of people still get kind of confused about all the different options. And of course, I've done a lot of content on that. Hacker Public Radio, my very first miniseries for it, is all about this sort of thing. And I'm pretty sure I've done a talk on this. So it's out there if you're really needing to know this sort of thing. Just kind of look that up. You know, me and video codecs should render some helpful links, I hope. But point being that FFmpeg will do threading and that you should utilize that if you're doing a really big job. I'm looking forward to threading it a lot more than just 4, now that I know that with those big files and the big playlists of files, it really makes a difference. So I'm really looking forward to seeing just how many threads I can take advantage of. Now, this is kind of a side note to this topic, but it's not exactly, but it really is. This, I don't think this is a secret. I think this has basically been the business model for a number of small-time hackers over the world, but it just kind of like hit me, and that is that there are people out there using very normal computers who have very real need for little tasks like this that are fairly trivial for you and I. Now, the actual technology, or rather the technique of the video conversion may or may not be trivial for everyone, but if you know that, if you know FFmpeg well enough, and you also happen to know a GUI programming language, a language that will render a GUI, then marrying those two things together, releasing it online for like 30, 40, 50 bucks, could be a real, that could make you money. It's really crazy. I kind of realized it myself as I was sitting there bailing this person out of, you know, I mean, they had what is supposed to be turnkey solution. I mean, everything is supposed to work on this platform that they're running. It's supposed to, in fact, famously just work. It is supposed to enable them to take a video camera out into the world, record a bunch of video, come back, dump it onto the computer, and then edit it, and then release it. And that's supposed to be everything. It's supposed to be easy. You're not supposed to have to know a whole lot of stuff to do that. You're supposed to be able to just be an artist and do that. And yet, there are cameras out there that record in one format that this computer just happens to refuse to recognize. And so, quite literally, like when they sit down and they have nowhere else to turn, and they're doing an internet search for my video editor cannot read this .mst file, that's all they know about it. And you and I know that it's a simple if FFmpeg command away, and yet just trying to explain that to someone, even the concept that FFmpeg is an application when really all you're doing is typing it into a terminal, so how can it possibly be an application? Because we all know applications are things that live in the applications folder or in my apps drawer, and I click on it, and it launches a graphical user interface. So clearly, FFmpeg is not an app. So, I mean, if you're able to program just a simple GUI that all it does is call FFmpeg on the back end, and you literally drop a file into a container, and it spits out your video and your audio in a format that this video editor suddenly can understand, that's a $30 sale at least right there. Possibly quite a bit more, especially if it's to a big institution with lots of computers. So there's a business there. There's a business model there. And it can be open source. It can be wide open source. It can be, you could copy paste the code right into the website and tell people, if you don't want to buy this program for $30, here's the source. There's a market out there of people who don't care about it being open source. They don't care that they can see the code. They don't care that they could compile it for free. They will pay you the $30 to $40 to $50 that you're asking for the quick fix, because all they want to do is sit down and make their movie. So there's a market out there, and if you're that kind of person who knows how to code and knows how to make money, then there you go. That's the answer right there. Go capitalize on that. I guarantee you, you can sell that thing, probably for a minimal effort in terms of the effort that you put forth just to marry together a simple interface and a simple thing that's already done, like FFmpeg. Put those things together, deliver it to people, make sure it has a pretty icon. You got money. So I don't know what that means to anyone. Honestly, to me, it means I should really go back to Python and figure out a simple GUI for FFmpeg and sell it to my employers. But I probably will never do that. So, but it is there. And once again, it's just kind of for people who say, oh, there's no money in open source. If we open source stuff, that people would never pay for anything. Programmers would starve. I really don't see that happening. I don't see that model ever working, because it assumes that people are going to be able to do stuff for themselves. And some of it is just too complex for them to be bothered. And it kind of goes back to the WordPress thing and the car thing that we were talking about at the beginning of this very episode. Some things people just don't want to have to learn, and they will pay for it. I'm a living example of that. I've bought things that I could have probably made from raw spare parts all around the world. I could have knit my sweater that I'm wearing right now, but I didn't bother learning that. So I paid someone instead. So, actually it was a gift, but point being, I would have paid someone for this sweater, or for the car repair, or whatever, because it's worth it. So, yeah, FFmpeg. Hard, but easy. Last but not least, I wanted to talk a little bit about HTML5. HTML5 is what HTML really, at least I think, should have always been. I realize some people disagree with me, because it's starting to roll in a lot of features that just aren't very text-based. But, I mean, honestly, I think that's where it has needed to be all this time. I mean, if you're not gonna use multimedia, then why even bother with HTML5? Why not just use Gopher sites with downloadable JPEGs and PNGs? You know, I mean, who cares? I mean, if you're not gonna actually utilize what HTML is for, which would be to present stuff in a certain way, then why bother? So I think HTML5 is exactly what HTML should have always been, and it's really great. It's my favorite implementation of HTML5 yet. There is, you know, the CSS and HTML thing is just, it's graceful, it works really, really nicely, and it's full of promise. You know, there's a lot of stuff going on still with HTML5. There's a lot of support for it, but there's a lot of activity happening there as well. The thing that I'm interested in, I guess, right now, at least in terms of talking about it right now, is the video tag. And the video tag has been around now for a while, but it's really starting to get implemented in all the different browsers, and it's still, from what I understand, something of it's in flux. And I have found that support for it is still a little bit spotty, depending on how out of dated people's Firefoxes are. But it's exciting stuff, and it's a really nice tag, and it makes inserting movies into web pages so much easier. I mean, for a while, I really wondered if we would ever get away from just embedded YouTube links, you know? I mean, that was the only way anyone was able to really reliably put a video on a web page. It was that bad. So the fact that this is all built in now is really cool. Obviously, the big noticeable broken part about this still are the different formats. And I think it's just such a pity that companies are being trivial and petty and are really fighting against, well, OGG first of all, but secondly, at least give me WebM, you know, at least concede to that. And they're not. So we have a total of basically three different file formats that we really kind of have to use when presenting video on a web page. Luckily for us, it's pretty easy to do, and that's what I wanted to talk about here. You don't have to do any kind of fancy PHP, detect what kind of user agent browser they're using, and guess which file format to deliver to them or anything like that. It's actually pretty simple. So the video tag itself is video space, and this obviously you could also just do the video tag and then give it a class and do all of this stuff in CSS, but I'll just do it inline here. So the tag would be, for instance, open tag, the greater than sign or whatever that is, video space, width equals, you know, whatever. Let's just say it's a 640 by 480. So quote 640, close quote, space, height equals quote 480, close quote, space, preload, that's for speed, space controls, if you want the controls, close the tag, not the tag, but close that to, you know, do the other one, the less than sign or the greater than sign, whatever that is. So that's your video tag. The item that it needs to contain is a source of the video. And that is open tag, source, the word source, S-O-U-R-C-E, space, src equals quote dot slash migratemovie dot ogv close quote space slash close quote. So it's a self closing tag, kind of like the image source tag, but this is source space source src equals the name of the movie, and then you close the tag on itself. Now we just did the OGG version, so that would be one thing in this video tag. And we could close the video tag. We could do the greater than slash video, less than, whatever. That would close the video tag. And you would have one OGG movie contained within this video tag. And if someone went there with Firefox, or actually it might just be Firefox, no, probably Chrome as well, and Conqueror, if they go there with those browsers, then they would see the OGG video. Now, on any other browser, on any other system, it would probably fail. Well, it might not fail on, like, Opera on another system or something, but it would fail on other proprietary browsers. And I do mean other proprietary, because Opera is not open source. So, so you've got that OGG file there. Now, having it fall back to some other format is actually really easy. So you do the video tag, video width equals height equals preload controls close, and then you do source, src equals quote migratemovie.ogv, close quote, close tag, and then just right there, still within the same video tag, you would put another source. So tag source space src equals migratemovie.webm, close quote, close tag, and then you could even do the much reviled, much hated proprietary alternative, tag source equal or source space src equals migratemovie.webm. MOV, or whatever, MP4, whatever, close quote, close tag. And then you close the video tag. Tag slash video, close tag. And that's it. That's how you do HTML5 video, such that it would fall back on whatever the browser can understand. So on Firefox, or probably Chromium and Conqueror, it would play, you know, like OGV, or maybe Chromium would play the WebM, I'm not sure. And then on other browsers, it would probably default to the h264.mov or mp4, whatever you've got that labeled as. And That's how you do it. It's a really, really easy tag. It's brilliantly simple. It's exactly like every other tag in HTML. You know, it's finally done in a way that normal people like you and I can actually understand. And the cool thing is that you just get that cool-looking, smoky, black, glass-looking player that you see. You get that for free. It just drops that into your browser, starts playing the video. It looks slick, and it looks cool, and it looks like it's really high-tech, and it is high-tech. It's HTML5, and it's playing your video regardless of the platform. So people, your friends, will be able to look at it on their proprietary cell phones, on their semi-open cell phones, on their computers, on their proprietary computers, on their stupid tablets, on their open source stupid tablets, you know, any device pretty much. It's going to have one of these three format supports, and so you'll be able to show people your movies no matter what, very nearly. So try that. It's a really simple little block of code. It's really very easy to implement, obviously, and people with up-to-date and even maybe slightly out-of-date browsers should be able to see one of those versions. So it's been working out really well for me. So enjoy. Episode. Thank you for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can find me online at GNUWorldOrder.info. You can IM me at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can talk to me in IRC. My nick is notklaatu, and I'm on the irc.freenode.net network, hanging out usually in Ogcast Planet, Slackware, a couple of other places, Slacker Media. You can email me, klaatu@member.fsf.org, or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org. And I think that's it. So thank you for listening, and talk to you next time.
I never expected you to make it this far. To be honest, I was ready to break down your cores and put them back in the scientific calculators I took them from.